but they had misjudged their quarry. They had come to kill a human. What they had found, unfortunately for them, was a demon. The Morrick waited for them to get closer, revealing nothing of its resistance to the poison, of its ability to shrug it off as nothing more than an irritation. When the closest of them, knife extended, rushed in from behind to finish it, the Morrick whipped around swiftly, took hold of the attacker's arm, and yanked it from its socket. The attacker screamed and fell writhing on the earth. The Morrick left this one where it lay and moved on to the next, catching it as it hesitated just a moment too long, fingers twisting tightly into the folds of its cloak. The Morrick yanked it off its feet and snapped its neck with a crack that sounded like the breaking of a piece of dead wood. The other two showed courage, or perhaps only foolishness, in choosing not to flee, but to attack as a unit, coming at the Morrick from two sides. A foolish, pathetic effort. The demon tore the face off the first and crushed the skull of the second, all so swiftly that the struggle was over almost before it had begun. A quick glance around assured it that no more attackers lurked in the shadows. That four had been deemed sufficient for the job. It pulled the attacker with the ruined face to its feet. It was still alive, though barely, and the Morrick licked the blood from what remained of its face. Sweet. It took a second lick, then snapped the man's neck and threw the carcass down. One by one, it went to each of them and finished the job. Then it took a moment to identify their species. It was surprised to discover that they were gnomes. Gnomes. Who would send gnomes to kill Iridia Illyri? The answer, of course, was obvious. Finding Iridia's presence at Arishag and her service to send Dunsadan intolerable, Shadea Aru had decided to take a hand in matters. The men must have been good at what they did, or the Ard Rhys wouldn't have sent them. Too bad for her, she didn't realize that Iridia was long since dead, and that what they were dealing with was something else entirely. But Shadea was no fool. She would discover that her assassins had failed, and she would take a closer look at what was really going on. She was already suspicious of Iridia's relationship with the Prime Minister. She would figure out soon enough that something about it was not right. Then she would try again, perhaps coming to do the job herself. The Morrick was not afraid of her, but it did not want to become involved in a druid feud that had nothing to do with its purpose in being in this wretched world in the first place. What it must do, it decided, as it walked away from the dead men, was to put an end to this nonsense. Its disguise had served its purpose, but it was becoming a liability. Its efforts at reaching the Elcries and tearing down the Forbidding were running up against obstacles it could not afford to spend time overcoming. Sen Dunsadan was recalcitrant. Shadea Aru was vengeful. Everything that lived and breathed in the Four Lands was a potential danger to it. Time, especially, was its enemy. Its mind made up, the Morrick licked a dollop of blood from its fingers as it continued on to its place of sleep. It would have to do something to change things. It would have to do so soon. Chapter 20. When she regained consciousness, Kyber Lesedil was sprawled on the catwalk, her body aching and her clothing soaked with her own blood. She pulled herself into a sitting position, glancing quickly about to be certain that the gnome hunter was still dead, lying where she had left him. The furnace room was unbearably hot, the tips of the flames from the pit dancing at the edges of her vision as if trying to climb out. She felt suddenly dizzy, weakened from loss of blood and fatigue, and took a moment to gather her strength. Then she tore the sleeve of her tunic away, folded it into a compress, slipped it under her clothing, and pressed it against the dagger wound. When she had it in place, She pulled her belt free and used it to bind the compress tightly in place. The effort took everything she had. She sat staring at the dead man, thinking that she had to move, that staying put was dangerous. Sooner or later, someone would come looking. She did not want to be there when they did. But where was it that she wanted to be? It was a question she could not answer easily. She had two choices. She could find her way clear of the keep and seek help on the outside, or she could stay where she was and try to find her way to the chambers of the Ard Ris, whichever she did. She had to do something to help Penn and Grian Olmsford avoid the Triagonel. If she failed, they would be snared and made prisoners, and the whole effort to rescue the Ard Ris would have been for nothing. She tried to think it through. Getting out of the keep seemed the safer choice. Put some distance between herself and the rebel druids and their gnome hunter protectors. But what would she do then? What sort of help could she expect to find outside Paranor? There were no communities for miles, no settlements, nothing but the heavy woods that surrounded the keep. She could not count on Kermadec and his trolls, or Tagwin to find her. She could not even count on them to get free of Stridegate. She had no idea what had become of the Olmsford senior. They could be anywhere. And they did not know she was at Paranor in any case. She knew she could not depend on help from the outside. Staying where she was made better sense, given that she had to come back in any case. But staying inside was also extremely dangerous. Enemies surrounded her. She did not know her way around. Everything about the keep was a potential trap, no matter how careful she was, sooner or later. She would make a mistake. Either way, she might be done in by her wound, which burned like fire. If she didn't bleed to death, she ran a good risk of infection. Her compress was already soaked through, sticking to her clothing and flesh both. She closed her eyes against her dilemma, trying to think it through. She would stay, she decided finally. Getting safely out of the keep risked as much as trying to remain hidden inside. There was no guarantee of any help, no matter which way she went. She might as well stay where she could do some good. How much time did she have? How long before Penn and the Ard Ris would come back into Paranor? It couldn't happen too quickly. He would have to find her first, and they would have to make their way back to the point of entry. But did time pass in the world of the Forbidding at the same speed it did in the Four Lands? What if the Ard Ris was still at the place where she had entered, and Penn found her right away? It was possible they might come back much more quickly than she imagined. She exhaled sharply. Too many questions, and there were no answers to any of them. She would have to do the best she could and hope that was enough. With both hands grasping the catwalk guardrail, she pulled herself to her feet. She tottered for a moment, leaned against the railing for support, and waited for her head to clear. She was still hanging there when she remembered the elf stones. In the heat of the struggle she had forgotten them, her throat tightened. Trant Rowan had given them to one of the gnome hunters. But which one? What if it was the one she had pushed into the furnace pit? Fighting back against the burn of her fear, she pushed away from the railing and staggered back around the catwalk toward the tunnel through which she had entered. She passed the blackened husk of the third gnome, turning her face away, trying not to look at him. She could not bring herself to begin her search there. Instead, she retraced her steps and went back into the darkened passageway until she found the first of the remaining two. In the near darkness, she searched him thoroughly, but she did not find the stones. Her heart sank. Taking his long knife from his belt so that she would have a weapon, she groped her way over to the second man. "Please," she prayed, her fingers rummaging frantically through his clothing. This time she found what she was looking for. A surge of relief washed through her as she shoved the pouch into her tunic. Whatever else happened, She could not afford to lose the talismans. Retrieving one of the torches she had extinguished earlier, she used her magic to relight it and then started back up the passageway toward the keep. If she encountered anyone at this point, she knew she was in trouble. There was no place for her to hide, and she was too weak to fight. She moved ahead at a steady but painfully slow pace, concentrating on putting one foot in front of the other, conscious that her strength was slowly ebbing away. She knew she would have to treat her injury soon if she was to keep going, but she could not afford to stop and do so until she was someplace safe. At some point, she lost her way, but she pushed on anyway. Eventually, she reached a confluence of tunnels, brightly lit with the smokeless torches the druids favored in the keep proper, and she cast her own aside. A stairway led upward, and she hesitated. She wasn't ready to go back into Paranor's upper regions just yet. Instead, she took one of the passageways leading off the hub. After passing several doors that were locked, she found one that wasn't, and slipped inside. A pair of smokeless torches cast a dim glow over a vaulted ceiling and stone block walls. She was in a storage room jammed high with casks of ale and wine, the oaken barrels iron-bound and tipped on their sides in huge cradles. A carpet of dust lay over everything. The air was thick with it. The room had clearly not been entered in a long time. She found that she could not lock the door from the inside, but she did not think she had the strength to look for another. If no one had been here recently, her odds were pretty good that no one would come soon. She worked her way to the back of the room, into the deep shadows, where she could not be seen by anyone entering, and collapsed on a wooden pallet used for storing barrel staves. She closed her eyes, wanting badly to sleep, but she knew if she did, she might not wake up again. She needed to stop the bleeding. Her healing skills were rudimentary, but Aaron had given her a few basic lessons. She knew she had to cauterize the wound. It would have been better if she were outside the keep where she could gather some healing herbs and leaves, but there was no help for it. She would have to make do with magic and luck alone. She knew it was going to be painful. She was not brave, and she did not want to do this. But she had no choice if she wanted to go on. She stripped off her tunic and pulled away the compress, then drew a little of the wine from one of the barrels and used it to wash the wound. The wine burned, and she clenched her teeth. It was a start, but it wasn't enough. For the healing process to begin, she had to close the wound all the way. She sat back down on the pallet and summoned a small magic that would help to numb the area around the wound, applying the dancing bits of colored light with her fingertips in gentle strokes. When the pain began to lessen, she brought out the long knife she had taken from the gnome hunter and used her magic conjured fire to heat the tip of the blade until it glowed. Then she bit down on a small piece of wood she found in a pile of scraps, summoned an image of Aaron and Embrun and better times to distract her, and laid the flat of the knife against the wound. The pain was enormous. Trying not to and failing, she screamed into the wood, into the silence, smelling her flesh as it burned and seared. She did not lose consciousness, although she thought it might have been better if she had. When she could stand it no longer, she took the knife away, tears streaming down her cheeks, fire coursing through her body. She summoned more of the numbing magic and applied it with small strokes to the cauterized area. It took her a long time to make a difference, but finally the pain decreased. She looked down at her side and then quickly away again. At least the wound was closed, and the bleeding stopped. She had done what she could. She pulled her tunic back on, wrapped herself in her cloak, and lay down to sleep, the knife gripped tightly in one hand. Beck stood at the controls of Swift Shore, easing the airship down the line of the Charnels toward the Dragon's Teeth and Paranor. The sky was hazy and gray, the midday sun blocked by storm clouds that were building into thunderheads. He watched the approaching weather, mostly out of habit. His thoughts were elsewhere. On the deck below the pilot box, Treffen, Maurice, and Bellazin sat together, heads bent close as they conversed. Kermadec, his brother Atalan, and a handful of other rock trolls were scattered about the aft decking, wrapped in blankets, and asleep. Tagwin was below decks, fighting air sickness yet again, apparently unable to come to terms with flight motion, even with help from Rue, who had given him herbs and a drink to calm his stomach. Some people were like that. No matter how hard they tried or how hard others tried for them, they simply couldn't make the adjustment. He glanced over his shoulder. Somewhere behind them, perhaps half a day out, the balance of Taupo Ruff's rock trolls followed aboard the huge flat transports that trolls favored for conveying their armies to a place of battle. Slow and cumbersome, they rarely got more than a few hundred feet off the ground, but Kermadec had insisted they would reach Paranor in time to be of help. His job, and the job of the small company he had brought with him, was to get inside the keep and secure at least one of the gates. Beck wasn't sure that 8 or 9 trolls could manage that against a fortress of druids and gnome hunters, but he kept his thoughts to himself. He wasn't sure, after all, that he could do what he intended either. He was flying the ship alone at that point, something he enjoyed and was comfortable with. He liked the feeling of satisfaction it gave him to be able to control her all by himself. He liked the way she rose and fell beneath his feet in response to the air currents. He knew Swift Shore better than any ship he had ever flown, and he had been flying for more than 20 years, ever since his journey to Parcasia aboard the Gerald Shannara, where Redden Alt Mer had taught him his flight skills and Rue Meridian had caused him to fall in love. If Tagwin was to be believed, falling in love appeared to have happened all over again with his son and the blind rover girl, Cinnaminson. An improbable happening under any circumstance, it seemed particularly strange here. Penn, following in the steps of his father, had fallen in love on a dangerous expedition at a place and time when falling in love was not convenient. Of course, that was the way love worked. You couldn't control the where or the when. So many similarities in their lives. Penn, too, was a flyer, although he had learned to fly much earlier, and was already as comfortable aboard an airship as his father. It was strange to think of Penn traveling down such a familiar road, but the comparisons were inescapable. But the strong possibility that, like himself, Penn possessed a secret magic gave Beck pause. He had been wrestling with the idea since the moment he had realized in his efforts to track his son that he was able to do so only because Penn had the use of a magic that neither he nor Rue had known anything about. Still, he could not ignore what reason and common sense told him about his connection to his son and, consequently, what it suggested about the possibility of another similarity in their lives. Beck, too, had possessed magic when he had gone with the druid Walker to Parcasia, and he hadn't known of it. It was only after they were well out over the Blue Divide and confronted with the barriers of Icehenge and the Squirm that Walker had revealed the truth about who he really was and how the magic had been passed down to him. He wondered when Penn had made his discovery. Had he known about it earlier and kept it secret from his parents? There was reason to think he might have done so, given his mother's antipathy toward magic and Beck's own reluctance to make use of it. It might also be that while Penn had known of it, he had not until recently fully explored its uses. It might be that he was still on a journey of discovery. Of one thing, Beck was quite certain. The King of the Silver River had chosen his son to make the journey into the Forbidding for a very specific reason, and it almost certainly had something to do with his heritage of the wish-song magic. The fairy creature could have come to Beck to do what was needed, but he had gone to Penn instead. That meant that something about Penn made him the more appropriate candidate for going into the Forbidding and rescuing Grianne. A boy, barely grown. It was almost impossible to understand. But the King of the Silver River had come to Olmesford's since the time of Shea and Flick in the days of Alannon. He had always done so with unerring instincts for what each of them was capable of achieving. Now it was up to Beck and Rue to find a way to help their son fulfill the charge that had been given to him. History was repeating itself, another instance of a similarity in the lives of the Olmesfords, and more particularly, in the lives of a father and son. Beck paused in his thinking. Would history repeat itself? Would it repeat in every particular? He had come back alive from the expedition he had embarked upon. Would Penn have the same good fortune? He hated thinking about such a question, but he could not help himself. In part, it was a reflection of his own sense of responsibility for his son. He had been given the task of seeing that Penn got safely back through the Forbidding. If he failed to do that, he would have failed his son. It was a possibility he refused to consider. "What are you thinking about?" Rue asked him. She stepped up into the pilot box and stood beside him, her green eyes inquisitive. When she saw the look that came over his face, she leaned over and kissed him. "What's wrong? Can't you tell me?" He nodded. "I was thinking about how much Penn depends on us, even though he doesn't know it." "He is supposed to depend on us. He is our son. I don't want to fail him." "You won't. Neither of us will." They were silent a moment, watching the land slide away beneath the airship's hull, the heavy weather west continuing to advance. Water birds from out of the Mulg swamp screamed eerie cries as they sailed across the skies. Far below, a cluster of forest trolls emerged from the trees and stalked in a line across the hills leading up to the mountains east. "Is Tagwin any better?" he asked. She shook her head. "He just isn't meant for this." "I guess not." He paused. "I'm worried about how much he really knows about getting into Paranor without being seen." "You ought to be," she said. He gave her a sharp look. "I asked him about it, and he admitted that he hadn't been inside those secret tunnels in several years, and that his memory of them was sketchy at best." "So we can't rely on him." She shook her head again. "How about Treffen Maurice and Bellison? Do they know anything that might help?"
"I don't think so. They've only been a part of the Order for a little over 2 years. They haven't had time to do much more than complete the lessons assigned them as novice druids. They are loyal to your sister, but they haven't had the closeness with her that Tagwin has. They didn't even know there were secret tunnels."
He looked off into the distance.
"So we have to depend on ourselves in this business."
She nodded.
"Pretty much like always."
He didn't say anything to that. When she awoke, Kyber Elesidil ached from head to foot, as if the cauterization had been applied across her entire body. She was not feverish, but she was disoriented and weak. She sat up, wishing she had something to eat or drink, and then remembered she was surrounded by wine and ale casks. She moved over to the closest barrel, opened the spigot, and took a long, satisfying drink of cool wine. She would have preferred water,
but the wine would suffice. She could do nothing about her hunger, though. She considered the possibility that there might be foodstuffs stored somewhere down in these cellar passageways, but she had no idea where they might be and no time to spend looking for them. She would have to get by on whatever she might scavenge along the way. What mattered just then was reaching the sleeping chamber of the Ard Righ as quickly as possible. Something, she realized, she did not know how to do. It was bad enough that she did not have a clear idea of where she was, so that she might have some sense of which direction to go. It was much worse that she had no idea how to reach her destination without being seen. She could find a way to disguise herself, she supposed, just as she had done when she had freed Penn. But that was risky, and, besides, even if she got that far, the sleeping chamber would be heavily guarded. Trying to decide where to begin, she considered her alternatives for a moment, but the task was hopeless. Everything she thought about trying was too dangerous. Once they found the dead gnome hunters, they would be looking for her anyway. Perhaps they already were. She needed to disappear, to become invisible. She pondered the idea. There were secret passageways in the walls of Paranor. Aaron had told her so once. The keep was honeycombed with them. The druids had used them to reach one another when they wished their conferences kept secret. The Ard Righ had used them from time to time as well, to slip from her chamber without being seen when need or discretion warranted it. If she could find a way into those, she would be lost all over again, she finished dismally. Unless... her mind raced. Unless she had a way to keep from getting lost. Her hand strayed to the pocket in her tunic where the elf stones were tucked away. The elf stones could keep her from getting lost. They could show her a way into the sleeping chamber just as they had shown Aaron the way to Stridegate and the Tanaquil. She was suddenly excited, the aches and pains and hunger forgotten. But then she remembered that use of magic as powerful as the elf stones was likely to be detected by the very people she was trying to avoid. It was the reason she had tried so hard not to use the stones on the journey into the charnels, using them in the druid's keep, right beneath their noses, would be madness. Besides, they thought the elf stones destroyed, thrown into the furnace along with her body. Any release of the magic risked revealing that she was still alive. Or did it? If the elf stones had been thrown into the furnace, would the intense heat and pressure destroy them? Would it serve to release the magic in doing so? No one knew, she suspected. There were no other elf stones save the ones she carried, and little was known about their properties. It might well be that their destruction would unlock their magic in the same way as a user's summoning. Anyway, what other choice did she have? She wondered suddenly how long she had been asleep. Did they know yet that she had escaped? Or did they think her dead, and the elf stones dead with her? She rose and left the storage room, slipping cautiously through the door, and went back down the passageways of the keep toward the furnace chamber. She picked up a torch on the way to provide her with the light she needed. She was hurrying by then, anxious to discover if her idea had a chance of working. It all depended on how much time had passed and what had happened in the interim. She moved quietly, listening for voices, for sounds that would indicate the bodies of the dead men had been discovered, that her deception was unworkable. But the passageways were silent and empty, and when she reached the place where the first two gnomes had died, she found their bodies untouched. Farther down, within the furnace room itself, she found the third as well. No one had missed them yet. No one had come looking. She still had a chance. One by one, she dragged the dead men to the edge of the fire pit and shoved them in. It would not conceal the struggle or the shedding of blood, but it would make it harder for those who eventually came looking to determine exactly what had happened. It might give her a measure of time and distance from discovery. She had to hope so, because it was all she had to work with. Exhausted from her efforts, she sat down with her back against the railing and took out the elf stones. She had to try to use them, even if the release of the magic alerted Shadea and the other rebel druids. She had to hope that they would register the source of the magic as the furnace room and attribute its presence to the destruction of the stones in the fire. She shook her head. She wished she had a better way. But she was stuck with things as they were, and there was no point wishing for something she couldn't have. She poured the elf stones out of their pouch and into the palm of her hand, studying them a moment. Then she closed her fingers tightly about them, held up her hand, and summoned the magic. It was easier this time than it had been before, perhaps because she was used to the process and more receptive to it. The familiar warmth spread from her hand through her arm and into her body before looping back again. When she was infused with the magic of the stones, her thoughts centered on what she needed, seeking a way into the secret passages of the keep. A blue glow formed within her fist and began to seep through the cracks of her fingers. Then, abruptly, it shot from her hand in a thin, long streamer, penetrating the fiery atmosphere of the furnace room, burrowing through stone and darkness, illuminating the way forward. She watched as her route revealed itself, a twisting of passages and stairways, cutting through the walls of the keep, winding steadily upward, until they ended at a wall that gave secret entry into the sleeping chambers of the Ard Ris. A strange glow leaked through the seams of the hidden door, a suggestion of magic contained within the room. Then the vision flared and was gone. The blue glow of the elfstone magic disappeared, and the warmth within her faded away. She sat again on the catwalk with her back to the railing, her memory of what she had been shown sharp and clear. High in the north tower, several floors below the sleeping room draped with the lethal netting of the Triagonel, the druid on watch in the cold chamber for disturbances triggered by unauthorized uses of magic noticed a spike on the otherwise smooth surface of the Scry waters. He leaned forward as the ripples spread outward, wanting to be certain of what he was seeing. The source of the spike was the druid's keep. He took a long moment to consider what that meant. Magic was in frequent use at Paranor, so disturbances of that sort were not unusual. Still, the spike suggested a usage more powerful than the conjuring normally done. He should report it, he knew. But he also knew that if he chose to do so, he must go before Shadea Aru, something no one wanted to do these days. He tried to think the matter through. It was possible that the usage was one the Ard Ris knew about. It was even possible that the usage was hers. The druid on watch did not want to intrude where he was not welcome. Discretion was well advised where matters involving Paranor and the Order were concerned, especially by those who only served. Drawing attention to oneself was not wise. Others had disappeared from the keep for much less. Besides, what sort of magic could be called up within these walls that someone in authority did not know about? He debated the matter only a moment more, then went back to his seat and resumed his watch. Chapter 21. Dawn was a faint glimmer in the east when Penderyn Ormsford stirred from his sleep and peered from his shelter into the gray, hazy gloom of a new day. Mist clung to the land in deep pockets. Clouds obscured the sky, thick and dull blankets that formed a canopy from horizon to horizon and refused to reveal the sun. The air was windless and raw with unpleasant smells, and the landscape wintry and bleak in the pale first light. The night's rain had ended, leaving dark stains on the bare earth and rocks. The dragon was right where it had been the night before, stretched in front of his shelter, like a wall. Only now, it was sleeping. Penn stared at it for a moment, not quite believing. Yes, the dragon was asleep, its eyelids closed, its huge, horn-encrusted snout resting comfortably on its wagon wheel feet, a steady snoring issuing from its maw and its nostrils flaring at regular intervals as it inhaled and exhaled. He waited long moments to be certain, then, carefully, climbed to his feet. His cloak wrapped close and the dark wand gripped firmly in one hand. A corridor opened to his left, leading just past the dragon's outstretched head, passing wickedly close to those teeth and claws, but offering a narrow avenue of escape. He just needed to be very quiet. And lucky. He took a deep breath and stepped from his shelter into the thin dawn light. Instantly, one scaly lid slipped open and the dragon's yellow eye stared at him. He froze, his blood gone cold, waiting to see if maybe, just possibly, the eye might not register his presence and simply close again. But it fixed firmly on him and did not move. He watched it for long moments, debating if he should try to go farther, then backed slowly into his shelter and sat down again. So much for that. He sat looking out at the dragon for a long time. He was so hungry he could hear his stomach growl. His nerves were ragged, and his hopes for reaching his aunt fading fast. Somehow, he had to get past the monster. To spend another day trapped in those rocks was unacceptable. He closed his eyes in despair. Didn't the dragon ever get hungry? Why didn't it leave and go off to find something to eat? Of course, dragons might not have to eat all that often, he reasoned. Maybe they only ate once a week, like the moor cats in the Four Lands. Maybe it had just eaten before it found him. Maybe it would never want to eat anything again as long as it had him to entertain it. Get out of here! He screamed in a rush of frustration. The dragon didn't move. It didn't even blink. But the runes on the dark wand began to dance wildly. He stared at them in confusion and surprise. The dancing continued for a few seconds more and then slowed. He furrowed his brow. His voice had disturbed them. They had become more active because he had shouted at the dragon. He found himself thinking again about how the runes continued to glow even while he was asleep and paying no attention to the staff at all. He had thought at first that the runes only brightened when they were responding to his thoughts, but that didn't seem to be the case. Hadn't been the case ever. From the moment he had encountered the dragon, the runes had acted independently of anything he had done, keeping the monster transfixed and at bay, even while he was sleeping. Why would they do that? They would do it, he thought suddenly, because the dark wand was sentient. The Tanaquil had given him a living piece of itself. That was what had enabled him to carve the runes without seeing what he was doing. That was what had transported him from the four lands into the forbidding. It knew to use the runes to charm the dragon, to mesmerize it, so that it would not attack Penn, just as it knew to guide him to the Ard Ris. It knew to protect him. But why had the runes responded to his voice? Shades! Because it was a thing of magic, and it would always respond to other magic, his magic, not his little magic, his ability to read the actions and behavior of other creatures in an effort to communicate with them, not the magic he had grown up with and kept secret even from his parents because he never thought it mattered. No, not that magic. Another magic. The wish song magic. Like father, like son. He could scarcely believe it. He had always understood there was a possibility of his inheriting such magic, but he had thought that possibility long past, faded with the passing of the years. He was too old. If it was going to happen, it would have happened earlier. Yet it hadn't happened to his father either, until he was a few years older than Penn was now. So it was possible that history was repeating itself. The blood heritage was a part of his past, but perhaps it was also a part of his future, its seeds locked deep inside him. He knew that his small communicative magic was born of it, even if it wasn't as powerful. And now, for reasons he didn't understand, the wish song had surfaced in him as it had surfaced 20 years earlier in his father. It had awakened in his voice and given him a way to connect to the magic of the Dark Wand. Except, he thought excitedly, he did understand the reasons for its emergence. The Dark Wand had awakened the wish song. His joining to the staff in the carving of its intricate web of runes had brought the magic to life. He looked into the distance, thinking that he was being foolish, that he had no reason to believe any of his conclusions. He glanced down at the staff, at the softly glowing runes, their patterns changing endlessly, dancing hypnotically across the darkened, burnished wood. He had no proof that the wish song's magic was what had stirred those runes, or, even if it had, that he could implement it in any useful way. But where was the harm in trying to find out? He began to hum, soft and steady, shifting tones and pitches, trying anything and everything. He kept at it, not knowing exactly what he was doing, just testing to see if anything he tried would make a difference. The response from the runes was immediate. They throbbed and pulsed, the glow shifting from rune to rune and from row to row, skipping here and there as if a thing alive. Patterns formed and were replaced almost quicker than the eye could follow, a kaleidoscope of brilliant images. The dragon lifted its head, fascinated. Penn changed from humming to stringing together words, not singing any specific song, just phrases that seemed to go together, seeking ways to make the runes do other things. But the runes just kept shifting about as they chose, with little regard to anything he did. They seemed to respond only to sound and not to specific words or meanings. Frustrated, unable to see how this was helping anything, he tightened his resolve, burrowed down inside himself, and gave a harder push to what he was doing. "Get away from me," he sang in a dozen different ways. "Go far, far away from me." Suddenly, there was a different response from the staff. Imprints of the runes literally jumped off the wood and into the air, glowing images that hung like fireflies against the sullen morning light. Still throbbing and pulsing, still shifting about in intricate patterns that kept the dragon mesmerized, the rune images danced about and then flew off into the morning mist. Line after line of glowing symbols broke free of the dark wand and winged away like birds taking flight. The dragon sniffed at them as they passed, and then licked out at them with its long, mottled tongue. But it could not capture them. Frustrated, it heaved its bulk off the ground and rose on its hind legs, maw splitting wide, scaly lips drawing back to reveal blackened teeth. Hissing and spitting, it snapped wildly at the images as they flitted past. Penn shrank back against the rock of his shelter in terror, but managed to keep singing. The dragon ripped at the images with its forelegs, and then finally, screaming with frustration as they continued to elude it, it spread great leathery wings and took flight, chasing after them. It happened so fast that Penn barely had time to register his sudden change of fortune before the dragon was gone, a dark speck in the distance, pursuing the still glowing images. Seconds later, it disappeared completely. Penn kept singing anyway, sending more flights of glowing runes in the same direction, worried that the dragon would decide to come back. When he finally thought it safe, he went silent. The images faded, and the runes on the staff ceased their excited dance and resumed a soft, gentle pulsing against the dark surface of the wood. All about, silence hung deep and pervasive on the hazy morning air. Penn exhaled sharply. What in the world had happened? The truth was, he didn't know. Obviously, he had tapped into the magic of the wish song, successfully summoning it from where it lay dormant within him. Probably, his link with the dark wand enabled him to do so, to bring the magic to life and to make use of it to save himself. But he had no idea what sort of magic he had conjured. He didn't know how to control it. He didn't really even understand how to use it. All he had managed to do was to make the Dark One's runes respond to him in a way that had lured the dragon away and given him a chance to be free. Beyond that, he hadn't learned a thing. But that was good enough. Wrapping his cloak close about him once more and gripping the Dark Wand firmly in one hand, he stepped out of his shelter and looked about. There was no sign of the dragon or anything else. The day was sullen and dark, and the air smelled of damp and rot. He needed to get out of that place. He needed to find Grianne Ohmsford and go home again. Turning his thoughts to his aunt, and mindful of how he had begun his search 2 days before, he held up the staff, pointed it south again, and watched the runes brighten. Then, with a last cautious look skyward, he set out. He walked all the rest of that day through country so bleak and so heavy with the promise of evil that he found himself constantly looking over his shoulder for what he imagined might be following. He took the trail leading up into the mountains, the passage he had chosen before the dragon trapped him, climbing steadily into the rocks through the morning and then descending on the other side in the afternoon. The day stayed dreary, the mountain air of no better quality than what he had found below. The haziness of the landscape was deep and pervasive. Not much grew anywhere he passed through. Mostly, the terrain was marked by different striations of earth and rock, a blending of washed-out grays and blacks and browns. It rained a little at midday. He cupped his hands to catch the precious liquid and licked the dampness from his palms. Other than that, he found only stagnant ponds and sediment-fouled trickles coming out of the rocks. Higher up, he encountered trees that bore a vivid crimson fruit, but he knew that bright colors and living things frequently indicated danger, and he passed the fruit by. He found a flock of crow-like birds eating berries from a bush, and though the berries looked unpleasant, he tried one anyway and found it edible. With an eye toward the crow birds, which were squawking at him angrily, he ate the rest. weary from his ordeal of the past few days, drained of energy in a way he had not expected, he rested at the crest of the pass for a time before starting down. Some of that had to do with the stress and fear that his encounter with the dragon had created, but some had to do with his not eating or sleeping well. The land had a draining effect on him, its blasted, empty terrain unbearably depressing. How anything could live in that world escaped him. He guessed that what lived there was a match for the land. Certainly the dragon was. He found himself hoping that the dragon was the most dangerous creature he would come across. But what were the chances of that? After his rest, he descended the far side of the mountains, following the long, winding thread of the pass toward a vast, misted plain that stretched away as far as the eye could see. The plain looked devoid of life, but he knew better than to expect that it was. Mist clung to its surface, twisting and writhing through deep ravines and skirting broad plateaus that lifted out of the flats like beasts rising from sleep. Skeletal trees jutted from the plains like bones, and here and there black pools of water shimmered slickly. He looked out across the plains in despair. Crossing those flats was not something he wanted to do. But what choice did he have? He had no idea how far he would have to travel to reach his aunt, or what he would find when he did. She had been there a long time by then. Anything could have happened to her. He took it on faith that she was still alive. He did not think the runes would direct him to her lifeless body. But she could be hurt, or damaged mentally or emotionally. She could have been made a captive or forced to endure any number of other unpleasant things. If she required physical assistance to get back to the doorway of the forbidding, how was he going to manage that? If she required medical help, what could he do to heal her? The more he thought about it, the more daunting the prospect seemed. Too much time had passed for everything to be unchanged in her life. Something would be wrong with her. Something would have happened. He was not looking forward to finding out what that was. He trudged on, reached the bottom of the pass, and struck out across the plains toward the heavily misted horizon. The dark wand was taking him south and east, turning him slightly from his previous path. The way forward was swathed in encroaching darkness that lifted out of the east like a shroud ready to be laid over a corpse. The land felt and looked like that corpse, and Penn supposed that it would be appropriate to lay a shroud over it. He did not care to be out and about when that happened, however, and he began to look for somewhere to spend the night. The clumps of rocks he had relied upon for protection and shelter the past few nights were missing here. All that was available were promontories, deep ravines, and stands of stunted trees. He chose the latter, thinking that if he could find a suitable clump in which to nest, he could conceal himself from whatever might come hunting by night. For what must have been the hundredth time, he wished he knew more about the land and its inhabitants, knowledge that might help keep him safe. But there was nothing he could do about his ignorance. He was there, and the only person likely to give him any sort of useful information was the person he was searching for. The light darkened from misty gray to deep twilight. A fog settled in, a thickening of the mist that slowly shortened visibility to a dozen yards. Penn had been making his way toward a particularly thick stand of broad-limbed trees, with branches so thoroughly intertwined it was difficult to tell where one tree stopped and another began. The canopy of limbs provided a shelter that might hide him while he sought to gain a little sleep. He questioned whether he could sleep at all given his uneasiness after the dragon experience, but he knew he had to try. He entered the woods just as darkness was closing down, found a stand of wintry, gray-barked hardwoods that were virtually bereft of leaves, and settled down in a patch of heavy, coarse grass nestled between a pair of ancient trunks. Wrapped in his cloak, He put his back against one of the trunks and watched the onset of night steal away the last of the light. When everything turned black, he listened to the ensuing hush. When the hush gave way to night sounds, he sat listening to those. When the sounds grew closer, a mix of clicks and huffs and low growls, he pressed harder against the tree trunk and brought the dark wand around in front of him for whatever protection it might offer. And then the sounds evened out and smoothed over, surrounding him but not coming so close that he felt the need to move, and his eyes began to grow heavy, his breathing to deepen and slow, and finally he slept. When he awoke, dawn had broken in a wash of familiar hazy gray light, and the surface of the surrounding land was covered in layers of vapor that ebbed and flowed across the contours of the terrain like an ocean's waves across a rocky shore. He stared out into the all but invisible distance, to horizons that ended much nearer than they had the day before and revealed nothing of what they concealed, and he was immediately depressed. He was hungry as well, but there was nothing to eat or drink, or at least nothing on which he wished to take a chance. So he turned his efforts to stretching cramped limbs and aching muscles, to finding fresh ways to make the blood flow sufficiently that he could get to his feet and go on. He could barely tolerate the thought of it, his search beginning to take on the feel of an endless odyssey, one that might not have an attainable destination, but would simply lead him on until he was lost beyond recovery in a trackless wilderness. He thought he might try to use his magic, to employ it to make contact with some of the vegetation or smaller creatures, and see what he could learn. It was all well and good to give himself over to the directional dictates of the dark wand, but it would be better if he could feel that he had some small control over his own destiny, just being able to know a little something more of the world through which he passed might help. He didn't yet have much confidence in his ability to get out of tight spots, and knowing that his magic could do more than make the Dark Wand's runes dance about would go a long ways toward changing that. He rose, finally, and looked about, peering through the gloom, trying not to breathe in the fetid smells of the dead wood and dank earth. The sky was lower today, more heavily clouded, as if rain threatened, and the mix of clouds and mist gave the sense of a sky and earth become joined. The way forward seemed immeasurable, a thick wall of gray that lacked any sense of up or down or sideways. He peered into it with trepidation and repulsion, then, reluctantly, set out. He walked for a time, but could not seem to get clear of the woods. He was certain they did not stretch far and that he had set out in the right direction, but trees continued to materialize through the wall of the mist, their tangled limbs linked web-like overhead. Finally, he stopped, directed his thoughts toward his aunt, and held out the staff. Nothing. At first he couldn't believe it. Then he panicked. Had the magic of the dark wand ceased to respond to him? He shook his head. No, that couldn't be. He turned to his left and tried again. Still nothing. He wheeled back in the direction from which he had come and tried a third time. This time, the runes flashed brightly in response. He had gotten turned completely around. Still a little afraid and not wishing to chance getting lost again, he kept the staff raised and his thoughts fixed and began to retrace his steps. He moved ahead carefully, watching where he placed his feet, taking note of the location of the trees, trying to form some sense of direction, even as he relied on the Dark Wand's magic to keep him from wandering astray. When he stepped from the woods, finally, clear at last, he found himself in a stretch of heavy grasses and rotting logs interspersed with stagnant, scum-laced ponds. The smell was terrible. He wrinkled his nose and glanced about apprehensively, took a quick reading from the staff, and moved ahead. He had gone only a short distance when he saw the bones. Gray and bare and broken, they lay scattered on a patch of bare earth. He stopped at once and stared at them. He did not know what kind of bones they were, but there were enough of them that he could tell that they came from more than one creature. From the number and their condition, he guessed they had been there for a long time. He was in the middle of a feeding ground. He looked about once more, suddenly aware of how quiet it was. A good idea to move away from this place, he thought. Sliding left through the grasses away from the bones, he walked as silently as he could toward another sparse copse of dead trees, trying to breathe evenly to keep his head clear and his thoughts collected. Don't panic, he told himself. Whatever feeds here isn't necessarily about. A high-pitched shriek stopped him in his tracks. A second responded to the first, and a third. They came from all sides, piercing and raw. A huge shape descended from the gloom, wings outstretched as it settled onto the log not 20 feet ahead of him. It was a vulture-like bird, its body as big as his own, its wingspan at least 12 feet. He watched it land, wings folding against its back, its narrow head lowering. When the head lifted a moment later, he saw that the bird had the face of a woman. But not any kind of woman he had ever seen. This woman had sharp, bony features, its mouth jutting and pinched in the manner of a beak, and its eyes hard and bird-like. Its body and wings were covered with dark feathers, and its feet ended in huge, hooked talons that seemed too big for the rest of it. Hunched so far over that it looked deformed, it sat on the log and watched him intently, but made no move toward him. He held his ground a moment, then started to back away. But another shriek rose, and a second bird woman swooped down right behind him, blocking his way. Then two more appeared, and two more after that, materializing out of the haze, wings flapping as they landed all about him, some on the ground, some on the limbs of trees, 12 at least he saw, all watching him, gazes hard and fixed. Harpies. He swallowed hard. He knew what harpies were. He had read stories of them in his father's histories of the four lands, vicious and unpredictable creatures. Harpies had been exiled to the Forbidding along with the other dark things in the time of Faerie. If memory served him correctly, harpies were flesh-eaters that were said to have preyed on men and animals alike. He glanced again at the talons of the one perched on the log in front of him and felt a fresh surge of panic. He needed to be somewhere else right away, but he didn't know how he could manage that, encircled as he was. Some of them had started to edge closer, making small, cooing sounds. They seemed pleased. They sounded eager. "Get away!" he shouted at them, waving his arms threateningly. Instantly, the runes on the dark wand flared, brightening like bits of fire, dancing up and down the wood. The harpies shrieked and flapped their leathery wings, and those advancing paused. Penn shouted at them some more and tried to move through them, but they quickly adjusted to keep him in place. He swung the staff at them. The runes danced even more wildly. The harpies flinched but held their ground. Penn felt an overwhelming sense of desperation. He had to find something more effective. He remembered the dragon then, and how his use of the wish song had sent the runes flying off into the distance, luring it away. Perhaps that would work with the harpies as well. He didn't have much control over how the magic worked, but it was all he could think of. He began to sing boldly, as if he might force his way through his attackers by the sheer force of his voice. He sang snatches of phrases and bits and pieces of things that just came to him, hoping that something would work. It did. Rune images spun off the staff in a glowing swirl and soared skyward, forming bright, complex patterns against the dark ceiling of the clouds. The harpies watched as the images lifted into the sky, but they did not follow. Penn's desperation increased. He didn't know what more he could do. He kept singing, punctuating his increasingly frantic efforts with shouts and cries, looking for something that would drive the harpies back. But having seen that his magic was confined to pretty glowing images that danced and flew and did nothing more, the bird women were advancing again. Their sharp eyes glittered in the dim light, and their strange mouths worked slowly up and down, opening and closing, hungrily. Penn gripped the dark wand tightly in both hands and prepared to use it as a club. It was all he had left. But just when it seemed that he was all out of chances, a dark shape appeared on the horizon, winging toward him, quickly growing larger and taking form. The dragon! It was tracking the rune images once more, following them to their source. How it had seen them from so far away, Penn couldn't know, but it was flying right for where the greatest number circled and danced against the clouds overhead. Their bright, hard eyes fixed on Penn, the harpies didn't see the dragon at first. Then the dragon screamed. There was no other word for it. And they swung about swiftly, necks craned, a fresh urgency in their posture. A few took flight immediately, but the rest hesitated, unwilling to abandon their prey. Plummeting out of the sky with such swiftness that Penn, who had thought he might try to make a run for it, had no chance to do anything but stand and watch. The dragon dropped on them like a stone. It snatched up the harpies the way a big cat might small birds, tearing them apart and casting them aside as fast as it could reach them. A few flew at the dragon with their wicked talons outstretched, but the beast simply crushed them in its huge jaws and flung them to the ground. The harpies screamed and hissed and flapped their wings frantically, unable to escape. One by one, the dragon killed them until only two were left, crawling about the blood-soaked earth and whimpering in despair. The dragon played with them, nudging them this way and that. Penn watched for as long as it took him to realize that he might be next, then, slowly, backed away. Rune images still danced and soared overhead, and fresh images leaped from the dark wand to whirl about the dragon like fireflies. If the dragon saw them, it gave no indication. For the moment, its attention was fixed on its new toys. Penn reached the edge of the woods without the dragon taking notice and slipped into the trees. After he was well into them, he put the dark wand beneath his cloak, closed down his thoughts of his aunt, and waited for the runes to go dark. Soaked in his own sweat, he pushed on, barely able to make himself move. He had thought the dragon safely gone, but it couldn't have been far away if it had seen the rune images. That should have made him happy, since it had saved his life, but it only made him further aware of how vulnerable he was. He might be saved for the moment, but he would remain in peril until he was out of the forbidding and back into the four lands. Until then, his lifespan probably didn't measure the length of his arm. He had to find his aunt. He had to find her quickly, or his luck would be used up. He kept walking, refusing to look back, heading in the general direction he knew he had to go. He kept the dark wand lowered and inactive, afraid to do anything that would bring the runes to life. He was half a mile away before he could no longer hear the crunching of bones. Chapter 22. No matter how often she scowled at him, he just wouldn't stop talking about it.
"Such power, Straken Queen! Such incredible power! No one can match you. No one who is or ever was. I sensed you were special. I did, Grianne of the Trees. When I first saw you from my hiding place and knew you for who you were, I knew, too, what you were. It was in your eyes and the way you carried yourself. It was in your voice when you first spoke to me. You awoke in a prison, sent by your enemies to be destroyed, and you still showed no fear. That is evidence of real power."
She let him go on, mostly because she didn't know how to shut him up. Wekedart was a bundle of pent-up energy, bouncing off the cavern walls and skittering across the uneven floor, darting this way and that, rushing ahead and then wheeling back. A wild thing in search of an outlet. She didn't think he could help himself. That was just the way he was, a creature of ungovernable whims and uncontrollable urges. He had been like that on the journey to the Forbidding's version of the Hadeshorn, so his hyperactivity was not a surprise. In any case, she was too tired to do much more than put one foot in front of the other and press on. "How much farther?" she asked at one point.
"Not far, not far," he said,
dashing back to take her hand, which she yanked away irritably.
"The tunnels open into the Pashanon just ahead. And then we will be back outside in the fresh air and light."
It was all relative, she supposed, picturing the world that waited with its greasy air and its dingy skies. She would not know true fresh air and light again, ever, if she did not get back into her own world. She found herself thinking again of the boy who was coming to find her, the salvation she had been promised by the warlock lord. He seemed such an impossibility that she could not make herself accept that he was real. But if he wasn't, she was trapped there forever, so she kept alive a faint hope that somehow he would appear, whether that appearance was reflected accurately in the words of the promise or in some less easily discernible way. She just knew it had better happen soon, because she was beginning to fail. She took a moment to measure the truth of that statement and found it accurate. It was happening in subtle ways, ways she did not think she could reverse while trapped within the Forbidding. Her physical strength was eroded, the result of poor food and drink, a lack of sleep, and the debilitating struggles she had waged with Tail Riverine. But her emotional and psychological strengths had been drained as well, and those in a more direct and damaging way. She had been forced to use the magic several times, and each time she had felt something change inside her. It was bad enough that she was forced to use it at all, worse still that she was forced to use it in such horrifying ways. Assimilating with the Furies had torn apart her psyche. Resisting the power of the Conjure Collar had all but broken her spirit. But her confrontation with the Gromph had reduced her to a new level of despair, one so fraught with bad feelings that she was literally afraid of calling up the magic again. It was the way the wish song had responded. She should have been thankful she still had command of it after all she had been through. She should have welcomed its appearance. But the strength of its response had terrified her. It had not only been greater than she had expected, but also virtually uncontrollable. It hadn't just surfaced on being summoned, ready to do her bidding. It had exploded out of her, so wild and destructive that she couldn't hold it back. She had lived with the wish song for more than 30 years, and she had known before coming into the Forbidding what to expect from it. But that was changed. The magic had taken on a new feel, become something she didn't recognize. It was a strange creature living inside her, threatening her in ways that made her afraid for the first time in years. What she feared most was that it had evolved because of where she was, and that the unforeseen evolution was changing her into something that belonged more to the forbidding than to her world. Yet what could she do to stop it? Weka Dart had probably done as much for her as he could. Debilitated or not, she was the one with the magic. If they were backed into a corner, she was the one who could help keep them alive. She would have to put aside her concerns about using the magic. The hunt for them would continue, and it would not end until she was free of the forbidding, or she was dead. They continued working cautiously through the tunnels below Kral Reach, and it wasn't long until there was a brightening of the darkness ahead of them. Within minutes, they had reached a fissure in the mountain rock, one that opened into the clouded mistiness of the Pashanon. They stood in silence for a moment, staring out onto a broad wetlands pocked by dozens of stagnant pools and vast stands of heavy grasses and thick scrub. The waters of the ponds nearest were covered in greenish slime and smelled of decay. Insects buzzed and chirped from every quarter. Swarms of gnats and flies hovered above the surface of the ponds, and snakes slid soundlessly through the shadows. The wetlands spread away for miles in all directions. Grianne shook her head in dismay. How do we get through this? Weka Dart looked over at her, eyes bright and teeth showing.
Follow me, Grianne of the wondrous magic, and I will show you.
Without pausing, he started out through the swamp. She followed with no small amount of misgiving, not certain she should trust his judgment, yet unwilling to be left behind. But the Ulk Bog seemed to know what he was doing. Even though the hazy light was pale and deceptive, he chose their path without hesitating. Now and then he would change course in mid-stride, turning another way. More than once, he reversed himself entirely, muttering about obstacles that hadn't been there before, that didn't belong, that had appeared merely to vex him. When a snake crossed his path, he simply reached down, snatched it up, and tossed it aside. He didn't seem afraid of them. He didn't seem to mind the clouds of insects either. He lapped at them with his tongue, hissed at them to clear his nostrils. Disgusted by her surroundings, Grianne settled for putting her arm and the sleeve of her tunic across her mouth and nose and lowering her head as far as she could without losing sight of the Ulk Bog. The odor of death permeated the air. She could feel the decay worming its way into her breathing passages. She used a little of the Wish Song's magic to keep it all at bay, not enough to give them away to anyone following, but enough to give her a measure of distance from the foulness. She cast quick glances all about as they went, searching for movement that might signal a pursuit, but nothing of that sort showed itself, and she began to wonder if perhaps chase had not yet been given. It seemed unlikely that the dead goblins hadn't been discovered in a changing of the guard, but it was possible. It was possible as well that even if they had been discovered, the search for her was still being conducted inside the walls of Kral Reach and hadn't yet extended to the Pashanon. Of course, when it did, she would be tracked down pretty fast if she was still out in the open. "Is there somewhere we can go to hide?" she asked Weka Dart at one point, hurrying to catch up with him as he slipped, eel-like, through the swamp. He gave her an irritated glance, feral features screwed up with concentration, breathing quick and heavy.
"A place to hide? Why would we hide, Straken Queen? If we are going to your world, we should go there at once."
She took a quick breath. She had forgotten that she had not told him of the boy, of the need for the boy to find her before she could go anywhere. "We might not be able to do that," she said. He wheeled on her, his face contorted with fury.
"What do you mean? We might not be able to do that. What are you saying, Grianne, of the broken promises?
She would not tolerate his insolence or his rebelliousness, not then, and not with what was at stake. She snatched his tunic front and yanked him close. "Don't question me, little Ulk Bog," she hissed. "I didn't make you a promise about how this would happen, or even that it would happen. I told you there was a chance I couldn't do anything to help either of us." He hissed back at her, then dropped his head and sulked.
"I didn't mean anything by it. You just upset me. You frightened me. I thought you had a plan."
She released him. "I do. But it relies on help from my own world. Someone is coming to find me. Someone who can get through the forbidding without help from Tail Riverine. We have to wait until he appears. I don't know when that will be, but if it doesn't happen before we reach the dragon line, then we might have to hide for a while. Do you understand?" He nodded sullenly.
"I understand."
"Then think about where we might go to do that, and stop being so suspicious." She kicked at him, and he started off again, skittering away through the grasses. There was no point in telling him everything, certainly not that she was waiting for a mysterious boy, for something of which she could barely conceive, for a miracle. She hated having told him she would try to get him out of the forbidding. She would not have done so if there had been any other way of securing his help. She had no idea if there was a way to free him, or even if such freedom was a good idea. In fact, it probably wasn't. But she would have said or done anything to escape Tail Riverine and thwart his plan to make her the bearer of his spawn. She shuddered at the thought of that, determined that she would die before she would let herself be taken by him again. They slogged on through the fading daylight, nightfall tracking them west until, sweeping slowly across the flats, it began to overtake them. They crossed out of the swamp and found dry ground beyond, a wintry plain in which the grasses were as dry as old bones, crackling beneath their feet as they stepped through them. Ahead, the land stretched away, bleak and empty, crisscrossed by deep ravines and dotted by hummocks. After a time, Weka Dart dropped back to walk beside her.
"I didn't mean what I said before."
He looked at her with his sharp, restless eyes, and then glanced away quickly.
"I know you keep your promises. I know you haven't lied to me. If anyone has lied..."
He shook his head.
"I can't help myself, you know. I have lied about everything all my life because that is how Ulk Bogs are. That is how we live. That is how we stay alive. We lie to keep others from gaining an advantage over us."
"I don't think lying does as much for you as you think," she replied. "Do you know what they say about lies? They say that lies have a way of coming back to haunt you." He shrugged.
"I just want you to know that I will change when you take me to your country. I won't lie anymore, or at least, I will try hard not to lie. I will be a good companion for you, Grianne of the Kind Eyes. I will help you do your work, whatever your work is. You will see that I am always there to do your bidding. Here, I would do the bidding of a Straken to stay alive. I would do it because I would have no choice, but it will not be like that with you. I will do your bidding because I want to, because I respect you."
She sighed wearily. "You don't know me well enough to promise that, Weka Dart. I am not what you think. I have dark secrets in my life. I have a history that is every bit as bad as that of Tail Riverine. I might not be like the demon now, but I was once, not so long ago." She paused. "I might still be like him in some ways." But the Ulk Bog shook his head stubbornly.
"No, you are not like him. You could never be like him."
But I was like him, she thought. the weight of the admission infusing her with a sadness she could barely stand. I could be like him again. Ahead, the flats turned rocky and were eroded by gullies and pocked by wormholes, the grasses and scrub disappearing entirely, the whole of the landscape changing abruptly to something Grianne hadn't seen before. Weka Dart, who was walking next to her but paying little attention to the land into which they were walking, suddenly caught sight of where they were going and drew up short, putting out his arm, urgently.
"Wait! Stay where you are!"
he snapped. He scanned the rocky flats, searching for something, then hissed sharply.
"This wasn't here before,"
he exclaimed.
"This is new. They've migrated from somewhere else and set up their colony here. How long, I wonder? Very recent. Very."
She looked down at him. "What are you talking about?" He gave her one of his frightening grins, the ones that showed all his needle-sharp teeth.
"Asphinx! This flat is riddled with them."
"The snakes?" His head cocked.
"Do you know about them?"
She did. Asphinx had been exiled to the Forbidding with the other dark things of faerie, except for one that had been sealed in a crevice by the Stone King, Yule Belk, in the caverns of the Hall of Kings to guard the Black Elfstone. Walker Bow, before he became a druid, had been bitten while searching for the talisman, and his arm had turned to stone. The story was a part of Beck's histories of the Shannara kin, a story she remembered as crucial to what happened to Walker later in his transformation into Alanon's heir. She glanced back at the flats. "How many are out there?" He shrugged.
"Thousands. Want to have a look?"
"No, I don't want to have a look. Can we get around them?" He gestured left.
"This way. Stay off the rocks and you won't have to deal with them. But watch your step anyway. If one bites you, you will make a nice statue for the birds to perch on."
They walked carefully around the colony, staying on the grassy fringe and keeping well back from where the rocks began. It took them a long time to get all the way to the other side, and by then, darkness had settled in so thoroughly that it was difficult to see more than a dozen feet. Weka Dart took a quick visual survey of their surroundings and nodded.
"We'll camp over there, in that stand of winces."
He gestured toward a small grove of needled trees that looked like diseased pines.
"Winces give us some protection. Snakes don't like their scent, and flying things can't get through the screen of their branches without first landing, which they won't do at night. A good place for us to get some rest."
Grianne glanced back the way they had come, toward Kral Reach. "Do you think they've begun to track us yet?"
"Oh, yes."
Weka Dart sounded indifferent.
"The Straken Lord will have found his guards and your discarded collar. He will have determined which way you have gone. He will have sent Hobbs Stall and his minions to bring you back."
His dark eyes glittered in the fading light.
"His magic is very powerful, Grianne Ohmsford, very powerful. But not so powerful as yours."
She knelt in front of the Elk Bog. "Listen to me. I know you want me to take you out of the Forbidding, and I have promised I will try. But if Hobstall and whatever dark things he commands catch up to us, I want you to leave me to deal with them. I want you to find some place to hide, and don't let them see you. Don't give yourself away." She paused. "They don't know about you yet, do they?" He snorted.
"Of course they know about me. Tail Riverine will have determined my presence as easily as he will have recognized your absence. Running and hiding will do me no good. I settled my fate by coming to you in the dungeons of Kral Reach, Straken Queen. That is why it is so important that you take me with you. If I remain in the world of the Jargarus, I am dead. Now come."
She ignored the sinking feeling in her stomach and followed him to the trees he called winces. They were tall, spidery, hard woods with long, thin, whip-like branches that interlaced and, at some points, knotted together. With Wekedart leading, they slipped into their midst, ducking more than once to get through, wending their way into the center of the grove. The Elk Bog made a quick check of their surroundings and determined them safe.
"Now, you should sleep while I keep watch," he told her. "We must set out early, and you will need your strength. Go ahead. Sleep."
Too tired to argue, she lay down obediently. She closed her eyes, thinking to do little more than nap. Her mind was awash in doubts and fears, in worries of what they would have to do to stay alive another day, images of her imprisonment and of the creatures that had threatened her paraded like specters. She felt the magic of the conjure collar even as she slept, ripping her apart, draining her strength, and filling her with pain. She would never sleep again, she thought, and was asleep in seconds. Her waking thoughts followed her into her sleep and became her dreams, dark and menacing. The Straken Lord tracked her down shadowy corridors, close behind but just out of sight. He carried in one hand the conjure collar with which he would bind her to him, its fastenings glittering like teeth. Other creatures from the Forbidding appeared in front of her, creatures of all sizes and shapes, their features not entirely distinct, but their intentions clear. Winged monsters clung to the ceiling overhead with claws that gripped like iron, threatening to drop on top of her if she dared to slow. She ran from all of them, blindly and helplessly, with no destination in mind and no end in sight. She came awake to the sound of howling wolves, and a terrified gasp escaped her lips.
"Sst!" Wekedart whispered in her ear. He was crouched next to her in the darkness, a vague shape, barely distinguishable from the night.
"Demon wolves! They've found us!"
She tried to scramble to her feet, but he forced her down again, hissing,
"No, no, don't move!"